This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 Chai FM.
And this is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and today's guest joining me, an old friend, a colleague, a fount of knowledge, lots of experience, Peter Fabricius. Peter is a colleague on the Daily Maverick when he writes for us. He's also a consultant and frequent writer with the Institute for Security Studies. And for years, he was associated with a major newspaper group. He was their foreign news editor for a while, and he was a Washington correspondent for, I think it was 5 long years in Washington. You almost became a citizen.
It would have been interesting.
That definitely would have been something. I'm really pleased to have you. And I think we're doing this in a very timely fashion because The other day you wrote a story at the Daily Maverick, which spoke to the new designated or nominated ambassador from the U.S. to South Africa, one Leo Brent Bozell III. There aren't them. He's third in his family with the name Brent. Mr. Bozell is an interesting character, as you correctly noted, no government experience. He's been a writer for many, many years. He was a fixture at an institution that he created dealing with what he referred to as the mainstream media's far left slant. If it matters, I'm busy reading some of his books right now. I will tell you, he is one glib, clever writer. Even if I disagree with most of what he says in many different ways, He is a very polished author, and that is an interest by itself. For a while, Peter, there was the rumor circulating in this country that Joel Pollack had the whole thing locked up. He was busy packing, basically. He was sorting stuff to stay and stuff to come with. It didn't happen. And maybe you can walk us through why it didn't happen and why now Mr. Brent Bozell.
Well, I mean, in a sense, I suppose ultimately the answer to those questions lies in the brains of one Donald Trump, which is quite inaccessible to normal human beings in many ways. But I certainly gather that he was punting his own candidacy quite hard, Joel Pollack. I mean, he's a South African-born guy, and he's also, you know, got taken huge interest in what goes on here. He lives in California, and he seemed to, I mean, it began to emerge quite recently that his candidacy was more in his own mind, perhaps, than in, you know, in the minds of the Trump administration. Although I gather, and by the way, I don't want to reveal any secrets, but it'd be useful for your listeners to also watch or listen to the podcast by Ferial Huffergy with him this evening, because he talks a bit about that. So he seemed to be on a short list. And then suddenly, boom, you know, it was this other guy. And now, why the other guy was chosen, the one theory that I've heard, which I wrote about, is that the Trump, it was quite ironic in a way, put him up for this position as head of this, I think it's called the U.S. Global Media Agency, which Correct. Is the overarching body supervising the Voice of America and some of these other kind of, I suppose you could call them sort of semi-propagandistic kind of radio outfits. But, you know, the Voice of America has got a fairly good reputation for objectivity, and Trump appointed him to head this agency in January, and then in March, boom, the agency was suddenly gone. You know, so he'd gone up to Congress to meet a few senators because he had a confirmation hearing coming up, and so on, and did all the necessary schmoozing and lobbying, and then boom, it almost sounded like, you know, it was like the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing, which I think is a bit of a problem with the Trump administration, that, you know, somebody gets appointed to an agency and then Musk comes along with his chainsaw and destroys it before he's had a chance to do anything. And so then, because that job fell away, so I heard, Trump felt that he owed this guy Bozell something. And South Africa was a nice, easy, you know, choice of position. Whether there's any greater intention in that, you know, as you mentioned, he's got no government experience. He apparently has no interest or experience or any interest that his experience would indicate in South Africa or Africa. So he'll be kind of taking off from a completely blank sheet. But he could be, as one of my commentators put it, one of my articles, could be quite a handful.
One of the things, and I'm working my way through two of his books at the same time, which is probably a bad exercise on my part. But one of them is more a collection of columns, and the other one is a sort of a narrative of what he has thought about things and people and places and organizations over the years. And as near as I can tell, he wasn't exactly a cheerleader for the old regime in South Africa, but he approved of some of it and felt it was unfairly being maligned as it was reforming. Put him in a fairly unusual place for somebody who would be appointed here now.
Was that in the 80s?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, I guess that was the, well, you would know as well as I, if not better, that was probably the constructive engagement kind of era, you know. And so, yeah, there were Reagan Republicans and Reagan administration supporters who did feel that it would be better to engage rather than sanction the apartheid regime. And who knows, maybe there was even some truth in that, you know. But as you say, also quite a minority position. Well, I would think a minority position.
It's reasonable enough to have sympathy for a government that is trying to reform itself. But what did de Tocqueville say about this? The most dangerous time for a corrupt and inefficient government is when it tries to reform.
Also depends. I mean, if you were doing that during the sort of PW era, it would be slightly different from, yeah. But that's when I guess constructive engagement, you know, was debated, you know, during the PW era. And I mean, PW's commitments to reform, as we know, were somewhat dubious, to put it mildly. And I thought you were going to say that he had some quite sharp criticism about Trump, which, according to my, I must confess, rather superficial research so far, also indicates that he, like quite a lot of people who are now ardent, you know, Trump supporters, he was very critical of him in the beginning for all the obvious reasons.
In one of the books, there is this wonderful, literally wonderful description of him being called to Donald Trump's offices in New York City in 2015, where Trump is chewing over the idea of now making a serious run for president. And Bozell is the sounding board, and he becomes increasingly admiring, is probably too strong a word, but appreciative of the man's sort of protean way of putting himself in things. And then he says more or less that by the time he won his nomination, let alone the election, Bozell was moving slowly but surely into, okay, he's going to do the things he said. Administration, the first one. We don't know what in the world's going to happen, obviously, although we've seen what happened so far. But one of the things that crosses my mind in all this, of course, is that the South African ambassador to the U.S., the one who just left under a cloud, Ibrahim Rasool, was effectively frozen out of his conversations with the U.S. government. Perhaps not with some people in Congress, and obviously not with the world that is not the government. Government officials, such as they had been appointed, Rasool was really unable to gain attention, get appointments, have conversations. Somebody like Bozell, is he going to run into a stone wall trying to deal with the union buildings and other places? It's going to be very frustrating.
Yeah, it could be. You know, I mean, there is a suggestion that just a hint of a suggestion, and it does show responsiveness by the Trump administration, which is not otherwise apparent, that they may have realized from reading the comments by South African government officials that Pollock wouldn't be very welcome, because he was, as you know, he played a role in Ibrahim's expulsion in a way, because it was his article in Breitbart News, which, you know, Marco Rubio cited when he declared Rasool persona non grata. So it may have been that they decided that this wasn't really something they wanted to deal with, you know, having a person in Pretoria who might very well get ignored. Yeah, this is the question, you know. I mean, the thing is that even if you're not a very diplomatic kind of a president and you don't have a very diplomatic kind of administration, you do have to ask yourself, is it worthwhile sending an ambassador to a country if no one's going to talk to him, you know? We've had that before on a small scale. I mean, there was an ambassador under Bush who was kind of shut out because he was publicly quite critical of the government. I think you might know who I'm talking about. Yeah. Funny enough, because he complained that even though the US provided lots of money to the South African, you know, government or human rights or, I mean, humanitarian sector, he had no access. So then he got less as a result. But it's going to be very interesting to me to see how he does perform. You know, I got this comment in my article from Bob Wokesa, who's one of the directors of the African Center for the Study of the US at Wits. And he thought the choice of this guy meant that, you know, the Trump administration wasn't interested in diplomacy, that they just he was just coming here to make a few tough points and, you know, force him down South Africa's throats. But I mean, that's a kind of a sort of short-sighted and not a very, seemed to me, a productive approach to take. But, you know, who knows? I mean, well, Trump is not famous for his diplomacy, so.
We're going to take a short station break. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and my guest today, Peter Fabricius, and we are trying to untangle the snarls and confusion of the Gordian knot that is U.S.-South Africa diplomatic relations. And we'll be back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest today, Peter Fabricius, old friend and sometime colleague, reporter, journalist with enormous experience in South Africa and in foreign affairs and in Washington. And this is one reason why we want to talk to him, because he spent years as a major newspaper group's Washington correspondent in some tough times. One of the things that struck me about this appointment, he may not have access in the traditional way that we're talking about Brent Bozell III, who's just been nominated as the American ambassador to South Africa. He may have trouble getting appointments with the president or with the deputy president or perhaps even the Durko minister, but I could see him very quickly becoming a favorite of television and radio and other things because he's very experienced at it and he's really good at it and he's tough-minded for his corner, let's put it that way. And he knows how to force the argument, and it will be interesting to see how others respond to the way he frames the discussion. Now, that he may not get the access that he would crave with the president, but is that necessarily what an ambassador is supposed to do, as opposed to make the points as best he can for his country's policies in the country that he is assigned? The old adage, a diplomat is sent abroad to lie for his country, is not exactly true. It's to make the best statements you can under adverse circumstances sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, that is going to be one of the very interesting things because, you know, one can easily imagine that he could make the same sort of diplomatic gaffe, if you want to put it like that, that Rasool made by coming out with some pretty, you know, sort of tough criticisms of the South African government on these frequent TV appearances, which you are forecasting you might well have. And then that puts South Africa in government in a spot about how much do we tolerate, bearing in mind, as they will be very much very clearly about what happened to Rasool. So, I'm having some difficulty in trying to kind of imagine how he's going to navigate this job, because they could have, just as in a way that I wonder if the South African government isn't going to send somebody to the U.S. who's just like a career diplomat and just keeps his head down and does what diplomats are supposed to do, keeps out of the limelight, or whether they're going to send somebody who's got a bit of charisma and personality and can like take on the opposition and use the media. So now we have someone who's a known critic, you know, of the things that South Africa stands for. I'm not sure that he's had much to say about South Africa itself. And so it's going to be very difficult it's quite difficult to see how he's going to navigate that job, you know.
No, I was going to say you've alluded to, you know, is he going to somehow suffer the same fate that Ibrahim Rasool suffered? Cast your mind back to the previous U.S. ambassador here, Reuben Brigati, who did, after all, have a fairly non-contentious term of office until one moment of exasperation. It only took, what, two or three sentences to sort of, you know, set the thing spinning in the wrong direction. And of course, we're referring to the Lady R and the presumed possibility that there were South African weapons aboard the ship on the way to Russia to help fight its war in Ukraine. You know, whether it was or wasn't, different issue. But Brigitte he got a little bit ahead of himself in terms of the evidence of which there was precious. But by the same token, the South African government, they called him in for a heart-to-heart talk. Basically, you know, he was told, basically, when you leave this office, don't sin anymore. But they didn't throw him out. They did not persona grata for the fairly strong criticism in a way that the U.S. seemed to have absolutely no Ibrahim Rasool. My suspicion is that South Africa finds it a little more difficult to toss out American ambassadors.
Yeah, look, I mean, sure. Although in a way, one could argue, I mean, there's no hard and fast, there's no gold standard about how you deal with these things. And it depends very much on, you know, the subjective impression of the host government about how offensive you've been. Although I think he probably came fairly close to being PNG'd, actually. And if it hadn't been for the fact that, you know, we're trying desperately to maintain good relations and not get it kicked out of a go and so on, I think he might well have been. Conversely, you could say that in normal circumstances, one might have expected that the U.S. would have called in Rasool for a, démarche is the expression they use, as you know, and given him a serious dressing down and said, please don't say that again. So as you say, if there's a difference in the way they handle these things, it's obviously very much related to the kind of imbalanced relationship in a way. And I guess that Bozil could get away with more, you know. I mean, I'm not sure how much, but just because South Africa will be trying quite hard, you know, again, to one of my scenarios, and I, you know, just long-term scenarios, and I don't know if it'll come to pass, at a certain point, South Africa may just say, to hell with this, you know. I mean, Ramaphosa is under a lot of pressure from his left wing to do just that. And you're seeing like sniping from the left. You have Nomvula Mokonyane sort of saying, let's rename Sandton Drive as Leila Khaled Drive and to hell with the US consulate. Let them print their letterheads and rub it in their faces, she said, you know. And that's a kind of a strong faction within the ANC. And it's getting stronger. In a way, I think the Trump's hostility is strengthening the hand of Ramaphosa's enemies in the tripartite alliance, which is it's kind of worrying in a way.
There is a counterbalance, though, within that broader community, which is, wait a minute now, you know, our economy is in something of a tender, shall we say. It's on its way to the ICU. It's not there yet, but we really don't want to make more enemies than we already have right now. We really don't want to encourage companies to look at Thailand or Chile instead. You know, the Nomvula Mokonyanes of the party can say what they want, but they don't have, or at least she doesn't have a position in the government.
Exactly. That is the position that Ramaphosa is trying to maintain. But all I'm saying in a way is that it might be getting more and more difficult for him to do so. And there may come a point, let's say, which now seems pretty likely, that we're not going to have our privileges renewed. That seems to be, I mean, the government itself seems to be accepting that. You know, you have the president's spokesman suggesting that maybe we should now start talking about proposing a bilateral, normal, you know, reciprocal trade deal with the U.S. and so on. So it's like a history, you know. And you may get to a point where the government may think, well, what are the benefits, you know, that we still have to maintain? I don't know. There's a bit of a balance.
Friends of mine in Washington who follow trade issues have said to me that, all right, forget about AGOA. It's gone. It may not be renewed anyway for the entire continent.
Yeah, exactly.
The thing South Africa should start really worrying about, which leads you to a bilateral trade negotiation or perhaps a multilateral one with a bunch of African countries, is most favored nation status. If they fall away from that, then it really is awkward. You harness that with this 25% tariff on foreign manufactured automobiles, going to be a little bit rocky. And we're going to take a quick ad break, and we will be back after these messages. This is The Deep Dive. It's Brooke Spector as your host, and my guest today, Peter Fabricius, who knows everything you need to know about bilateral relations and the larger compass in which they take place. with his position with the Daily Maverick, with the Institute for Strategic Studies, and with decades of experience as a reporter and analyst for major newspapers. We'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooks Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooks Spector, your host, and my guest today, Peter Fabricius. And before we took our break, we were just stepping into the question of what South Africa needs to think about, or what South African government officials, probably better put, need to think about in terms of preserving benefits and opportunities with its trading relationship with the United States, assuming AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, becomes history in just a few months for all of Africa, or at the minimum for South Africa. And I mentioned I think we'll have to devote a couple of hours to explaining just how that works and what it means. But it would, if you lose that status, let's suffice it to say, then you lose a lot of leverage in terms of the comparative competitiveness with other countries' level and economic circumstances.
I think the MFN is like the sort of general universal benchmark, and then obviously AGOA and the GSP as well, general system of preferences and so on, over and above that. So they give you, I mean, AGOA gives us a little bit of an edge in market for autos and whatever, fruit and wines and stuff, and critically so, I think. I don't think, you know, I think our auto, as I understand it, our auto export to the US might just collapse completely without AGOA and without MFN. Pack it up. So it is.
I want to add just one note. We were talking about Brent Bozell as the designated nomination for ambassador to South Africa from the US. I'll say it plainly now. I would love to have him on my show or as an interviewee, because it will be vastly entertaining. It might be a little frightening, but it will certainly be something people will want to read or listen to, because of the way he has, with the phrasing he does, of arguments and issues.
Yeah, I know, that would indeed be very fascinating. On that score, I don't know if you've seen, but I read, I mean, my research so far into this guy, who I hadn't heard of until a few days ago, as most of us hadn't, showed me that at a certain point he still has, I think, a column, syndicated column in a couple of papers in the US, and one of the newspapers dumped him because it was discovered that, in fact, he wasn't writing his column. A colleague was. And I noticed since then they are now both credited as co-author. So, but one would hope that he's as articulate in the flesh as he is on the written page when you come to meet him. But yeah.
for what it's worth, I met his father, I believe, years and years ago, because I'm fairly old. As a high school student, I went to a conference about politics and international relations. And his father was a firebrand right wing as well. And I didn't know a whole lot about the right wing in American politics. This was just about the time of Barry Goldwater, which goes back a few weeks. and I didn't realize until fairly recently that the son now was 69 years old already, younger than I am. You know, he's had a full career of being an agent provocateur politically against his enemies.
Well, it's interesting that you remember his dad from so long ago. Yeah. So he must have been quite a memorable person. And as you know as well, and I mean, I was interested to read his uncle, this guy's uncle, our future ambassador's uncle, was William Buckley, who's one of the great, great sort of, what would you call them, the icons of U.S. conservatism. So he comes from quite a genetic pool of conservatism.
I'm going to turn the topic a little bit, and we're going to look at the other side of things, which is not so much that Ibrahim Rasool was asked to pack up his bags and move along and return and give a lachrymose speech at the airport that was filled with a bit of self-pity. The thing that I noted about his airport speech was he had a whole tick list of things that he wanted to accomplish and said, oh, didn't do that one. Oh, didn't do that one. Didn't get that one done either, which under other circumstances might have been marked as things did not go well, aside from the webinar that got him into serious trouble.
I suppose he could have been defended on the grounds that he expected to be there for longer than 2 months.
I guess that's part of it. But now, looking forward, the South Africans will have to appoint somebody to fill that space, because it's too important to leave vacant forever. Yes, there is a chargé or a chef de maison, whatever the South Africans call their number two in an embassy, but that's different than having someone who speaks directly on behalf of the government in the top at the top of the mission level. And there are a number of people who are being mentioned as potential candidates, some farcical and some pretty serious. Andreas Nell, deputy minister of justice, mentioned. Some people think that Trevor Manuel, wonderful. I almost said Trevor Noah, but I figured, no, that's not going to work.
There's an idea.
That would be kind of fun, maybe, but I think he's now a U.S. citizen, so we can't really see that work. Yeah. So Trevor Manuel, I even heard the name mentioned at least once of Carl Niehaus, but I don't think that's going to fly.
No, that must have been a parody. The other name you haven't mentioned, of course, is Tony Leon.
Yes.
Who was proposed quite seriously although spontaneously by Helen Ziller in an interview, and seems to be in the mix. I mean, the thing is that the Democratic Alliance is more generally complaining that it's being ignored on foreign policy, which is true. And there are people in the ANC who are claiming, in my view, wrongly, that the statement of intent of the government of national unity gives them a monopoly over foreign policy and foreign policy appointments, which is not true, not the way I read it. So he's been put up there in part to, you know, I suppose, because he would probably do a pretty good job. He was a very good ambassador, I think, in Argentina a few years ago, and he's a, you know, articulate guy. But his name is also being put up, I'm sure, to advance a more general argument that the DA should have a greater say in foreign policy. On the perhaps less serious side of the spectrum, and I mean, some people propose this quite seriously, there's been a suggestion that Ernie Els might be a good guy because he is, Trump doesn't know that many South Africans other than those who are now in his inner circle and live in the States, other than a few golfers. And a few years ago, Ramaphosa told me quite seriously during Trump's first tour that he was thinking, well, remember, he also had a clash with Trump about white farmers complaining that their land was being seized and being attacked and murdered and, you know, subjected to genocide and so on. And he proposed, Ramaphosa seemed to be seriously suggesting that he might ask Ernie Els and or Gary Player to go engage Trump on the golf course and, you know, smooth things over. I don't think that is a serious suggestion now, but it's interesting.
We're going to take a short station break. This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and my guest today, Peter Fabricius, and we are trying to untangle the snarls and confusion of the Gordian knot that is U.S.-South Africa diplomatic relations. And we'll be back after these messages.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and my guest today, Peter Fabricius. If you are joining us late, we've been talking about the new appointed or nominated U.S. ambassador to South Africa. Obviously, there are a fair number of steps to proceed. The name has to be vetted and a confirmation hearing in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in the U.S., and then a vote by the full Senate, and then the nomination is forwarded officially to South Africa for their agrément, or who don't speak French. And only then does the appointee get to pack their bags and show up. And there's even probably some time when they go off to the so-called ambassador's charm school, where they learn at least some of the ins and outs of what it is the job actually entails, as opposed to what it is in the movies. And then, of course, we have the other side of the equation, the sudden vacancy in the South African embassy on Massachusetts Avenue in Washington, with the end of Ibrahim Rasool's tenure in Washington. And I was posing the question to Peter just before the break, what are the requisites? The new ambassador, whoever he or she is, because I also saw Lindiwe Sisulu's name being mentioned by a couple of people. I'm not sure about how that would work either, but be that as it may, the new ambassador shows up, they present their letter of credence to the Secretary of State and the President, and their first day in office begins officially. And what's on their priority list? What do they have to do before anything else happens?
Yeah, that is It's such a difficult question that I actually wonder whether, or anybody else that I can imagine would really want this job, you know, because it's in a sense a poison chalice. And you might want to do the job, I suppose, because, you know, you go over the top with your guns, you know, out of the trench and into the fire, because that's your patriotic duty. But other than that, really difficult to see how anybody could imagine that this job is going to be a lot of fun. So obviously what the Rasul experience teaches us is the first thing you do is not do certain things. You know, you do not publicly criticize your host government in that sort of fashion, which you did. I mean, that whole episode has become very polarizing. And if you say what I'm saying now, there's some people can say you're a coward and you're advocating hypocrisy and kowtowing to you. Well, you know, the thing about diplomacy, it does have a healthy dose of hypocrisy in it. And it basically means not one of the first rules, you do not criticize your host government publicly. So that would be the first thing to do is not to do that. And then after that, what becomes difficult is that, you know, if you look at the approach the South African government has taken, I mean, Ibrahim Rasool was probably doing this and the South African government has been doing it. And the envoys have gone there. The South African government has not yet, to the best of my knowledge, sent the envoys that Ramaphosa was promising to send in his State of the Nation address. But the DA sent people, and they just ran into a bit of a war, even they, trying to explain that, for example, the Expropriation Act is not about, you know, mass seizure of land and so on. And it seems like the Trump's administration and even others in Congress don't really want to hear explanations of policy. They want a change in policy. So that means that if you want to improve relations with US, the Trump administration, and hopefully avoid getting kicked out of a go, if that's possible, as you say, it might not be because the whole thing might be shafted. But you'd have to do things like, you know, rescinding the non-compensation clause from the Expropriation Act, or withdrawing the case against Israel at the ICJ, because that's when it comes to foreign policy issues, that's really what's in the crosshairs of the Trump administration. As we know, under the Biden administration, it was South Africa's playing footsie-footsie with Putin that was most irritating. Now you have Trump and Putin in kind of the same side of the fence in a way. So Russia has kind of slid off the agenda of the checklist of things they don't like, and it's very much now Israel, Iran is in the center.
I was going to say, Iran figures more in that in a lot of ways than some people think.
Yeah, and but the two, of course, are very closely related. Iran supporting Hamas, which attacked Israel on October 7th, 2023. Israel retaliates massively. South Africa decides they're committing genocide, takes the ICJ to Israel to the ICJ. And which is where, you know, which is what is really irritating the Trump administration. So, you know, it was interesting to me before Rasool left. I had an interview with him before he left for the US, and he said, "Oh, what we have." I said, "How are you going to?" The last time you were there, you were ambassador to the Obama administration, which was friendly, sympathetic. Now, very unfriendly administration. What are you going to do? He said, "The one thing we have to do is turn down the volume on the megaphone on Gaza and treat it, actually, as he put it, as a sub judice issue." He said that he and Ramaphosa had agreed on that before he left, which meant, you know, just leave it to the court. So they're not going to withdraw it, but they leave it to the court and they don't shout. And they have kind of done that, but with some exceptions. There's this op-ed that Ramaphosa signed onto with some other foreign kind of leftist leaders that irritated the Pollocks of this world. He commented on it because it basically brought up the whole ICJ case, the ICC case against Israel, and so on.
It was the Foreign Policy Magazine article, right?
Yeah, the Foreign Policy Magazine article, exactly, which I suspect was something that Ramaphosa kind of agreed to without paying much attention, and suddenly there it was, you know, with his name on it, to his probable regret. I don't know. I'm just guessing. So I don't know. So you can do that. You can turn down the megaphone. You can just leave it to the court. But I suspect that isn't going to be quite enough to hack it. You know, that you probably have to withdraw the case. So I don't know what an ambassador does. Just tries to keep a low profile. You know, I mean, it's a bit of a defeatist way of looking at it. But I can't see how what an ambassador can do short of some actions which Pretoria would have to take, which it's clearly not going to take. You know, I don't think.
One of the things that does occur to me is there's an imbalance in the way South Africans think about their relationship with the U.S. in the U.S. Somehow there seems to be a feeling that they are at the top of the list of places to be discussed with, that they are crucial to the changing world of global politics. Donald Trump seems to want to do is the ultimate in real politic diplomacy and create a sphere of influence, share the world with Russia, with China, let other places pretty much fend for themselves. And that seemed to be underlying the cuts in aid and the cuts in natural research. And in fact, the imposition of a whole range of tariffs, of which I can't keep track of because they keep changing, and then this most recent one with automobiles. But there is a misapprehension, in my mind at least, of how South Africans see their place in the U.S. diplomatic universe.
Yeah, look, for a long time, and still the ANC has suffered from delusions of grandeur, I mean, to put it, you know, bluntly. And it was not a surprise to me to discover that they absolutely insisted when the GNU was formed last year that they're going to have foreign affairs, you know, they're going to have international relations. And they've got the minister, both deputies, and they've got that. And now they're saying that it's actually a monopoly. It's an ANC monopoly foreign affairs. So they've always suffered from this. What I think is a delusion of grandeur that, you know, we always have to be worrying about the balance of forces in the world, how the neoliberals are doing compared to the international progressives and, you know, that kind of thing. But I think more sensibly, though, in spite of that, there were a lot of people that were hoping, I mean, as you suggest, that South Africa might be such a low priority for the Trump administration that it might just be ignored. And unfortunately, I think what's happened is that with the likes of Musk and with Pollock and others, Peter Thiel and so on, so close to Trump, it's been put on his table. You know, it's been put on the desk in the Oval Office. And amongst all the zillion of other things that you'd think would be more important for him to worry about, he's issued a number of, I don't even know how many that has applied to South Africa, quite a few. And it's quite hard to sort of figure out at any moment where we are. In these orders, but that, you know, cancelling aid, cancelling this, threatening, you know, various other things. So unfortunately, even though we are a very low priority, I'm sure, in his global scheme of things. And I think that where we figure, unfortunately, is because as Rubio pointed out when he issued that tweet saying that he wasn't coming to the G20 foreign ministers meeting, the themes that we chose of diversity, equity, and inclusivity are precisely the things that they're trying to fight in the US. So we've kind of managed to put ourselves in the crosshairs as a sort of epitome of all the things that, you know, Trump doesn't like. Even though we are, I mean, where are we in the lists of U.S. trade partners? Like about 120, I would think. You know, not very high, but yeah. But he's an ideologist, you know, and I think that's our problem in a way.
Well, we don't have a whole lot of time left. I'm going to put you in the spotlight further and say, all right, if you had your choice, who? And we have like 2 minutes left to do this. Who would you pick to send as South Africa's envoy to the United States in these troubled waters?
That is a tough one. Yeah, you know, Leon's good. Andres is good. Trevor would be good. I wonder if a career diplomat might not be the best choice, just because it's such an impossible job. You sort of have to wonder whether we'd be wasting, you know, the talents of a politician of talent to send them there when the real ish, as I said, the real decisions have to be made in Pretoria, and how likely are they to be? Well, on the other hand, maybe they could convey a message. I really don't know. I mean, I think he's not going to get the job because I think that the ANC would, it's the last thing they would agree to. But I think Tony Leon would do a good job.
I mean, there are a couple of real candidates. And then, as you say, there are a whole collection of senior diplomats who've actually worked as diplomats. And given the troubled circumstances, maybe somebody who actually understands how to keep a calm, low profile and deal with things as they come along rather than go around hammering the 95 theses on the cathedral door. Unfortunately, I have to break this off. We've run out of time, but I really do appreciate it. Very timely conversation, I think. We're halfway between naming one ambassador to naming the second one. And when we know who the other one is, maybe you can come back and we can talk about how that's going to work.
It'll be great.
This is Brooke Spector, the host of The Deep Dive, and Peter Fabricius has been my guest today. And we've been doing the rounds, the diplomatic rounds, and what it's going to take and how the names are going to be apportioned, picked, and decided upon. Come back next week and join us. This is The Deep Dive. We have a different topic every week, and experts and knowledgeable people. And it's always something new for every one of us to learn. You have a good weekend and take care.